The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa, read to you by Blue Friend, September 2016. Chapter 2. The great temple seemed to be a living thing. From my vantage point, high in the roof, I could look down and see the whole vast extent of the place. Earlier in the day, my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and I had journeyed to this place on a special mission. Now the Lama was closeted with the high dignitary, and I, free to wander, had found this priestly observation post amid the mighty rafters which supported the roof. Prowling about on the walkway of the roof, I had discovered the door and daringly pushed it open. No loud shout of wrath greeting the action, I peeped inside. The place was so emptied, so I entered and found myself in a small stone room, like a cell built into the stone of the temple wall. Behind me was the small wooden door, stone walls on either side, and before me a stone ledge perhaps 3 feet high. Silently I moved forward and knelt so that only my head was above the stone ledge. I felt like a god in the heavens, peering down on the lowly mortals, peering down on the dim obscurity of the temple floor so many feet below. Outside the temple, the purple dusk was giving way to darkness. The last rays of the sinking sun would be fading behind the snow-covered peaks, sending iridescent showers of light through the perpetual spume of snow flying from the very highest ranges. The darkness of the temple was relieved and in places intensified by hundreds of flickering butter lamps, lamps which shone as golden points of light, yet still diffused a radiance around. It looked as if the stars were at my feet instead of over my head. Weird shadows stole silently across mighty pillars, shadows now thin and elongated, now short and squat, but always grotesque and bizarre, with the cross lighting making the usual seem unearthly and the unusual strange beyond description. I peered, staring down, feeling as if in a half-world, uncertain of what I was seeing and what I was imagining. Between me and the floor floated clouds of blue incense smoke, rising in layer after layer, reminding me even more of a viewpoint of a god looking down through the clouds of the earth. Gently rising clouds of incense swirled thickly from the censers swung by young and devout cellas. Up and down they paced, silent of foot and immobile of face. As they turned and turned again, a million points of light reflected from the golden censers and sent forth dazzling beams of light. From my vantage, I could look down and see the red glowing incense as, fanned by the breeze, it at times almost flared into flames and sent off showers of red, fast-dying sparks. Given fresh life, the incense smoke rose in thicker columns of blue to form trailing paths above and behind the cellas. Rising higher, the smoke formed yet another cloud within the temple, wreathing and twisting on the faint air currents from moving monks. It seemed like a thing alive, like a creature dimly seen, breathing and turning in sleep. For a while I gazed, becoming almost hypnotized with the fantasy that I was inside a living creature, watching the lift and sway of its organs, listening to the sounds of the body, of life itself. Through the gloom, through the clouds of incense smoke, I could see the serried ranks of lamas, trappas, and chelas. Sitting cross-legged upon the floor, they stretched in their endless rows until they became invisible in the farthest recesses of the temple. All in their robes of order, they appeared as a living, rippling patchwork of familiar color. Gold, saffron, red, brown, and a very faint sprinkling of gray, the colors seemed to come alive and flow into each other as their wearers moved. At the head of the temple sat His Holiness, the Inmost One, the 13th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, the most revered figure in the whole of the Buddhist world. For a time I watched, listened to the chant of the deep-voiced lamas, accented by the high treble of the small cellas, watched the incense clouds vibrate in sympathy with the deeper vibrations. Lights flickered into darkness and were replaced. Incense burned low and was replenished in a shower of red sparks. The service droned on, and I knelt there and watched. Watched the dancing shadows grow and die upon the walls. Watched the glittering pinpoints of light until I hardly knew where I was nor what I was doing. An aged lama, bent under the weight of years far beyond the normal span, moved slowly before his brothers of the order. Around him hovered attentive trappas, with sticks of incense and the light at hand. Bowing to the Inmost One, and turning slowly to bow to each of the four corners of the earth, he at last faced the assembly of monks within the temple. In a surprisingly strong voice, for so aged a man, he chanted, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. Life on earth is but a dream that, in the time of life eternal, is but the twinkling of an eye. Hear the voices of our souls, all you that are sore depressed. This life of shadow and sorrow will end, and the glory of life eternal will shine forth on the righteous. The first stick of incense is lit, that a troubled soul may be guided." A trappa stood forth and bowed to the Inmost One before turning slowly and bowing in turn to the four corners of the earth. Lighting a stick of incense, he turned again and pointed with it to the four corners. The deep-voiced chant rose again and died, to be followed by the high treble of the young cellas. A portly lama recited certain passages, punctuating them by ringing his silver bell with the vigor occasioned only by the presence of the Inmost One. Subsiding into silence, he looked covertly around to see if his performance had obtained due approval. The aged Lama stepped forward once more and bowed to the Inmost One and to the stations. Other Trappas hovered at ready attention, over-anxious in the presence of the head of state and religion. The aged Lama chanted, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. Life on earth is the testing, that we may be purified of our dross and soar ever upwards. Hear the voices of our souls, all you that are in doubt. Soon the memory of the earth life will pass away, and there will be peace and release from suffering. The second stick of incense is lit, that a doubting soul may be guided." The chanting of the monks below me increased and swelled again as the Trappa lit the second stick and went through the ritual of bowing to the Inmost One and pointing the incense to each corner in turn. The walls of the temple appeared to breathe, to sway in unison with the chanting. Around the aged Lama, ghostly forms gathered, those who had recently passed from this life without the preparation, and who now wandered unguided and alone. The flickering shadows seemed to leap and writhe like souls in torment. My own consciousness, my perceptions, my feelings even, flickered between two worlds. In the one, I peered with rapt attention at the progress of the service beneath me. In the other, I saw the between worlds, where the souls of the newly departed trembled in fear at the strangeness of the unknown. Isolated souls, clad in dank, clinging darkness, they wailed in their terror and loneliness. Apart from each other, apart from all others because of their lack of belief, they were as immobile as a yak stuck in a mountain bog. In the sticky darkness of the between worlds, relieved only by the faint blue light from those ghostly forms, came the chanting, the invitation of the aged Lama. "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. As man died in the greater reality that he might be born on earth, so must he die on earth that he may be reborn again to the greater reality. There is no death, but girth. The pangs of death are but the pangs of birth. The third stick of incense is lit, that a soul in torment may be guided." Into my consciousness came a telepathic command. "Lobsang, where are you? Come to me now." Jerking myself back to this world, by a great effort, I staggered to my numb feet and tottered out the little door. "I am coming, respected sir," I thought to my guide. Rubbing my eyes, watering in the cold night air after the warmth and incense smoke of the temple, I stumbled and felt my way along, high above the ground, to where my guide was waiting, in a room right over the main entrance. He smiled as he saw me. "Lapsang," he exclaimed, "you look as if you've seen a ghost." "Sir," I replied, "I have seen several." "Tonight, Lapsang, we shall remain here," said the Lama. "Tomorrow we shall go and call upon the state oracle. You should find the experience of interest. Now it is time, first for food and then for sleep." While we ate, I was preoccupied, thinking of what I'd seen in the temple, wondering how this was the world of illusion. Quickly, I finished my supper and went to the room allotted to me. Wrapping myself in my robe, I lay down and soon was fast asleep. Dreams, nightmares, and strange impressions plagued me throughout the night. I dreamed that I was sitting up wide awake, and great globes of something came at me like the dust in a storm. I was sitting up, and from the distance small specks appeared, growing larger and larger, until I could see that the globes, as they were now, were all colors. Growing to the size of a man's head, they rushed at me and streaked away beyond. In my dream, if it was a dream, I could not turn my head to see where they had gone. There were just these endless globes pouring out of nowhere and rushing on past me to nowhere. It amazed me immensely that none of the globes crashed into me. They looked solid, yet to me they had no substance. With such horrid suddenness that it shook me wide awake, a voice behind me said, "As a ghost sees the stout, solid walls of the temple, so now do you." I shivered in apprehension. Was I dead? Had I died in the night? But why was I worrying about death? I knew that so-called death was merely rebirth. I laid down and eventually fell asleep once more. The whole world was shaking, creaking and tumbling in crazy manner. I sat up in great alarm, thinking that the temple was falling around me. The night was dark, with only the ghostly radiance of the stars above to shed the merest suspicion of light. Gazing straight ahead of me, I felt my hair rise in fright. I was paralyzed. I couldn't move a finger, and worse, the world was growing larger. The smooth stone of the walls coarsened and became porous rock from the extinct volcanoes. The holes in the stone grew and grew, and I saw that they were peopled with nightmare creatures which I had seen through the Lama Mengyar Dondup's good German microscope. The world grew and grew, and frightening creatures grew to ponderous size, becoming so vast with the passage of time that I could see their pores. Larger and larger grew the world. Then it dawned on me that I was becoming smaller and smaller. I became aware that a dust storm was blowing. From somewhere behind me, the grains of dust roared by, yet none of them touched me. Rapidly they grew, larger, larger. Some of them were as large as a man's head. Others were as large as the Himalayas, yet not one touched me. Still they grew larger, until I lost all sense of size. Until I lost all sense of time. In my dream, I appeared to be lying out among the stars, lying cold and motionless, while galaxy after galaxy streaked past me and vanished into the distance. How long I remained thus, I cannot say. It seemed as if I laid there through eternity. At long, long last, a whole galaxy, a whole series of universes, swung down directly upon me. This is the end, I thought vaguely, as the multitude of worlds crashed into me. Lobsang, Lobsang, have you gone to the heavenly fields? The voice boomed and re-echoed around the universe, rebounding from worlds, re-echoing from the walls of my stone chamber. Painfully I opened my eyes. I tried to get them into focus. Above me was a cluster of bright stars which somehow seemed familiar. Stars which slowly vanished to be replaced by the benign face of the Lama Mingyar Donda. Gently, he was shaking me. Bright sunlight streamed into the room. A sunbeam illuminated some dust motes, and they flashed with all the colors of the rainbow. Lobsang, the morning is far advanced. I've let you sleep, but now it's time for you to eat, and then we'll be on our way. Wearily, I scrambled to my feet. I was out of sorts all morning. My head seemed to be too big for me, and my mind was still dwelling upon the dreams of the night. Bundling my scant possessions into the front of my robe, I left the room in search of Sampa, our staple food. Down the notched ladder I went, hanging on grimly for fear of falling, down to where the cook monks were lounging about. "I have come for food," I said meekly. "Food at this time of the morning? Be off with you," roared the head cook monk. Reaching out, he was about to give me a blow when another monk whispered hoarsely, "He's with the Lama Mingyar Dondab." The head cook jumped as if he'd been stung by a hornet, and then bellowed to his assistant, "Well, what are you waiting for? Give the young gentleman his breakfast." Normally, I should have had enough barley in the leather pouch, which all monks carry, but as we were visiting, my supplies were exhausted. All monks, no matter whether chelas, trappas, or lamas, carried the leather bag of barley and the bowl from which to eat it. Sampa was mixed with buttered tea and thus provided the staple food of Tibet. If Tibetan lamasaries printed menus, there would be one word only to print, Sampa. Somewhat refreshed after my meal, I joined the Lama Mingyar Dandap, and we set off on horseback for the lamasary of the state oracle. We did not talk while journeying. My horse had a peculiar motion which required my full attention if I were to remain in place. As we traveled along the Lingkor Road, pilgrims, seeing the high rank of my guide's robes, called to him for blessing. Receiving it, they continued the holy circuit, looking as if they were at least halfway to salvation. Soon we walked our horses through the willow grove and came to the stony path leading to the home of the oracle. In the courtyard, monk servants took our horses as, thankfully, I at last slid to the ground. The place was crowded. The highest lamas had traveled the length and breadth of our country to be present. The oracle was going to get in communication with the powers that ruled the world. I, by special arrangement, by special command of the Inmost One, was to be present. We were shown to where we would sleep, I next to the Lama Mengyar Dondup, and not in the dormitory with many other Chelas. As we passed a small temple within the main building, I heard, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion." "Sir," I said to my guide when we were alone, "how is this the world of illusion?" He looked at me with a smile. "Well," he replied, "what is real? You touch this wall and your finger is stopped by the stone. Therefore you reason that the wall exists as a solid that nothing can penetrate. Beyond the windows, the mountain ranges of the Himalayas stand firm as the backbone of the earth, yet a ghost, or you in the astral, can move as freely through the stone of the mountains as you can through the air." "But how is that illusion?" I asked. "I had a dream last night, which really was illusion. I feel pale even to think of it." My guide, with infinite patience, listened while I told of that dream, and when I had finished my tale, he said, "I shall have to tell you about the world of illusion. Not for the moment, though, as we must first call upon the oracle." The state oracle was a surprisingly young man, thin and of very sickly appearance. I was presented to him. His staring eyes burned straight through me, making tingles of fright race up and down my spine. "Yes, you are the one. I recognize you well," he said. "You have the power within. You shall have the knowledge also. I will see you later." The Lama Mengyar Dondup, my beloved friend, looked well pleased with me. "You pass every test, Lobsang, every time," he said. "Now come, we will retire to the sanctuary of the gods and talk." He smiled down at me as we walked along. "Talk, Lobsang," he remarked, "about the world of illusion." This sanctuary was deserted, as my guide knew in advance. Flickering lamps burned before the sacral images, causing their shadows to jump and move as though in some exotic dance. Incense smoke spiraled upwards to form a low-lying cloud above us. Together we sat by the side of the lectern from whence the reader would read from the sacred books. We sat in the attitude of contemplation, legs crossed and fingers entwined. "This is the world of illusion," said my guide. "Wherefore we call to souls to hear us, for they alone are in the world of reality. We say, as you well know, hear the voices of our souls. We do not say, hear our physical voices. Listen to me and do not interrupt, for this is the basis of our inner belief. As I shall explain later, people not sufficiently evolved must first have a belief which sustains them, makes them feel that a benevolent father or mother is watching over them. Only when one has evolved to the appropriate stage can one accept this, which I shall now tell you. I gazed at my guide, thinking that he was the whole world to me, wishing we could always be together. "We are creatures of the spirit," he said. "We are like electric charges endowed with intelligence. This world, this life, is hell. It is the testing place wherein our spirit is purified by the suffering of learning to control our gross flesh body, just as a puppet is controlled by strings manipulated by the puppet master. So is our flesh body controlled by strings of electric force from our over-self, our spirit. A good puppet master can create the illusion that the wooden puppets are alive, that they act of their own volition. In the same way, until we learn better, we consider that our flesh body is the only thing that matters. In the spirit-strangling atmosphere of the earth, we forget the soul that truly controls us. We think that we do things of our own free will and are answerable only to our conscience. So love sang, we have the first illusion. The illusion that the puppet, the flesh body, is the one that matters. He stopped at the sight of my puzzled expression. Well, he asked, and what troubles you? Sir, I said, where are my strings of electric force? I cannot see anything connected to me by my over-self. He laughed as he replied, can you see air, love sang? Not while you're in the flesh body. Leaning forward, he grasped my robe, nearly scaring the life out of me as I stared into his penetrating eyes. Love sang, he said sternly, have all your brains evaporated? Are you really bone from the neck up? Have you forgotten the silver cord, that collection of lines of electric force linking you here with your soul? Truly, love sang, you are in the world of illusion. I felt my face grow red. Of course, I knew about the silver cord, that cord of bluish light which connects the physical body to the spirit body. Many times when astral traveling, I had watched the cord shimmering and pulsing with light and life. It was like the umbilical cord which connects the mother and the newborn child. Only the child, which was the physical body, could not exist for a moment if the silver cord was severed. I looked up. My guide was ready to continue after my interruption. When we are in the physical world, we tend to think that only the physical world matters. That is one of the safety devices of the over-self. If we remembered the spirit world with its happiness, we would be able to remain here only by a strong effort of will. If we remembered past lives when perhaps we were more important than in this life, we should not have the necessary humility. We will have some tea brought in, and then I will show you, or tell you, of the life of a Chinaman from his death to his rebirth and to his death and arrival in the next world. The Lama stretched forth his hand to ring the small silver bell in the sanctuary and then stopped at my expression. "Well," he asked, "what is your question?" "Sir," I answered, "why a Chinaman? Why not a Tibetan?" "Because," he replied, "if I say a Tibetan, you will try to associate the name of someone you know with incorrect results." He rang the bell, and a servant monk brought us tea. My guide looked at me thoughtfully. "Do you realize that in drinking this tea, we are swallowing millions of worlds?" he asked. "Fluids have a more sparsely molecular content. If you could magnify the molecules of this tea, you would find that they roll like the sands beside a turbulent lake. Even a gas, even the air itself, is composed of molecules, of minute particles. However, that is a digression. We were going to discuss the life and death of a Chinaman." He finished his tea and waited until I finished mine. "Seng was an old mandarin," said my guide. "His life had been a fortunate one, and now, in the evening of that life, he felt a great contentment. His family was large, his concubines and slaves many. Even the Emperor of China himself had shown him favors. As his aged eyes peered short-sightedly through the window of his room, he could dimly discern the beautiful gardens with the strutting peacocks. Softly, to his failing ears, came the song of birds returning to the trees as the day grew old. Seng lay back, relaxed upon his cushions. Within him he could feel the rustling fingers of death, loosening his bonds with life. Slowly the blood-red sun sank behind the ancient pagoda. Slowly old Seng sank back upon his cushions, a harsh, rattling breath hissing through his teeth. The sunlight faded and the little lamps in the room were lighted, but old Seng had gone, gone with the last dying rays of the sun." My guide looked at me in order to be sure I was following him. "Old Seng lay slumped upon his cushions with his body sounds creaking and wheezing into silence. No longer did blood rush through his arteries and veins. No longer did body fluids gurgle within. The body of old Seng was dead, finished with, no more use. But a clairvoyant, if one had been present, would have seen a light blue haze form around the body of old Seng. Form then lift over the body, floating horizontally above, attached by the thinning silver cord. Gradually the silver cord thinned and parted. The soul which had been old Seng floated off, drifted like a cloud of incense smoke, vanished effortlessly through the walls. The lama refilled his cup and saw that I also had tea, and then continued. The soul drifted on through realms, through dimensions, which the materialist mind cannot comprehend. At last it reached a wondrous parkland, dotted with immense buildings, at one of which he stopped. Here the soul that had been old Tsang entered and made his way across a gleaming floor. A soul, Lob Tsang, in its own surroundings, is as solid as you are upon this world. The soul in the world of the soul can be confined by walls and walk upon a floor. The soul there has different abilities and talents from those we know upon the earth. This soul wandered on and at last entered a small cubicle. Sitting down, he gazed at the wall before him. Suddenly, the wall appeared to vanish, and in its place he saw scenes, the scenes of his life. He saw that which we term the Akashic Record, which is the record of all that has ever happened, and which can be seen readily by those who are trained. It is also seen by everyone who passes from the earth life to the life beyond. For man sees the record of his own successes and failures. Man sees his past and judges himself. There is no sterner judge than man himself. We do not sit trembling before a God. We sit and see all we did and all that we meant to do. I sat silent. I found all of this of quite absorbing interest. I could listen for hours, better than dull lesson work. The soul that had been old Tsang, the Chinese mandarin, sat and saw again the life that he, upon earth, had thought so successful. Continued my guide, he saw and sorrowed for his many faults, and then he rose and left the cubicle, going speedily to a larger room where men and women of the soul world waited him. Silently, smiling with compassion and understanding, they awaited his approach, his request to be guided. Sitting in their company, he told them of his faults, of the things he had attempted to do, things he meant to do and failed. "But I thought you said he was not judged, he judged himself," I said quickly. "That is so," Lob Tsang replied my guide. Having seen his past and his mistakes, he now approached these advisers in order to receive their suggestions. But do not interrupt me. Listen and save your questions for after. As I was saying, continued the Lama, the soul sat with the advisers and told them of his failures, told them of the qualities which he had to grow in his soul before he could evolve further. First would come the return to view his body. Then would come a period of rest, years or hundreds of years. And then he would be helped to find conditions such as were essential for his further progress. The soul that had been old Tsang went back to earth to gaze finally upon his dead body, now ready for burial. Then, no longer the soul of old Sang, but a soul ready for rest, he returned to the land beyond. For a time unspecified, he rested and recuperated, studying the lessons of past lives, preparing for the life to come. Here in this life, beyond death, articles and substances were as solid to his touch as they had been on earth. He rested until the time and conditions were prearranged. "I like this," I exclaimed. "I find it of great interest." My guide smiled at me before continuing. "At some predetermined time, the soul in waiting was called and was led forth into the world of mankind by one whose task was such service. They stopped, invisible to the eyes of those in the flesh, watching the parents-to-be, looking at the house, assessing the probabilities that this house would afford the desired facilities for learning the lessons which had to be learned this time. Satisfied, they withdrew. Months later, the mother-to-be felt a sudden quickening inside her as the soul entered and the baby came to life. In time, the baby was born to the world of man. The soul that had once activated the body of old Sang now struggled anew with the reluctant nerves and brain of the child Li Wong, living in humble circumstances in a fishing village of China. Once again, the high vibrations of a soul were converted to the lower octave vibrations of a flesh body. I sat and thought. Then I thought some more. At last I said, "Honorable Lama, as this is so, why do people fear death, which is but a release from the troubles of earth?" "That's a sensible question, Lobsang," replied my guide. "Did we but remember the joys of the other world, many of us would not be able to tolerate hardships here. Wherefore, we have implanted within us a fear of death." Giving me a quizzical sideways glance, he remarked, "Some of us do not like school, do not like the discipline so necessary at school. Yet, when one grows up and becomes adult, the benefits of school become apparent. It would not do to run away from school and expect to advance in learning. Nor is it advisable to end one's life before one's allotted time." I wondered about this because just a few days before, an old monk, illiterate and sick, had thrown himself from a high hermitage. A sour old man he had been, with a disposition that made him refuse all offers of help. Yes, old Jigme was better out of the way, I thought. Better for himself, better for others. "Sir," I said, "then the monk Jigme was at fault when he ended his own life?" "Yes, Lobsang, he was very much at fault," replied my guide. "A man or a woman has a certain allotted span upon the earth. If one ends his or her life before that time, then he or she has to return almost immediately. Thus we have the spectacle of a baby born to live perhaps a few months only. That will be the soul of a suicide, returning to take over the body and so live out the time which should have been lived before. Suicide is never justified. It's a grave offense against oneself, against one's over-self. But, sir, I said, how about the high-born Japanese who commits ceremonial suicide in order to atone for family disgrace? Surely he's a brave man that he does that. Not so, Lobsang, my guide was most emphatic. Not so. Bravery consists not of dying, but of living, in face of hardship, in face of suffering. To die is easy. To live, that is the brave act. Not even the theatrical demonstrations of pride in ceremonial suicide can blind one to its wrongness. We're here to learn. We can only learn through living our allotted span. Suicide is never justified. I thought again of old Jigme. He was very old when he killed himself, so when he came again, I thought, it would be only for a short stay. Honorable Lama, I asked, what is the purpose of fear? Why do we have to suffer so much through fear? Already I have discovered that the things I fear most never happen, yet I fear them still. The Lama laughed and said, that happens to us all. We fear the unknown. Yet fear is necessary. Fear spurs us on when otherwise we should be slothful. Fear gives us added strength with which to avoid accidents. Fear is a booster which gives us added power, added incentive, and makes us overcome our own inclination to laziness. You would not study your schoolwork unless you feared the teacher or feared appearing stupid in front of others. Monks were coming into the sanctuary. Chelas darted around, lighting more butter lamps, more incense. We rose to our feet and walked out into the cool of the evening, where a slight breeze played with the leaves of the willows. The great trumpet sounded from the potala so far away, and dimly the echoes rolled around the walls of the state oracle lamasery. End of chapter 2.